Hello.
Hello, is this John?
This is John. How you doing?
Oh, sir, I'll tell you what. I was running about 78% since 9 o'clock, but after I heard your voice, I went to 108 just that fast.
Okay.
Okay, John. Hey, listen, thank you so much for taking your time to be with us today. I indicated to you, I said the world's waiting for you, and I don't know that they'll all be logged on right this moment, but through iTunes, we'll be able to get this message out to the world, just like you do on your own, off your own website.
Well, so, I appreciate that, and I apologize for being late here, but
yeah,
I'm ready.
It happens, doesn't it?
Yep, all the time.
Okay. Listen, let's begin. And by the way, if I may call you you John, just
yes.
Refer to me as Jim. Is that okay?
That sounds good, Jim.
Okay, fine. Tell us about your website, and tell us about your website, and also perhaps we might get a hold of your books if you have any, and your email address.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sorry. I missed the last end of that.
Yeah, your website, your books, and your email address.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, the website is nationallibertyalliance.org, and probably the best way to get a hold of me, the email that comes directly to me, if you go onto the website and click on contacts, then you can send email directly to me right off the website. There's a place to put in your name, your email, and your message. My phone number is available also on the website.
Okay.
And you know, basically, our website is constructed for the sole purpose of teaching people. You know, we realized quite some time ago what Jefferson had said concerning the people. And maybe I'll just read a couple of his quotes. Might be the best way to start things off. And this is right on the front page of our website. You know, on our website, we make the statement, only the people can save America. And the question is will you? Will you stand up to do it? You can't elect someone to save your republic. It's just not going to happen. The assembly in your state or the Senate in your state's not going to do it. Washington, D.C. is not going to do it. And even if you were to elect someone like Ron Paul, who was running for president, he's not capable of saving the nation. Only the people can do it. Only the people to rise up in every corner of the nation. And so what our purpose is to educate people, because we've been kind of de-educated, if I might use that kind of a term. We've been lack of education. They've taken control of our schools, and they don't teach us anything but except how to be a good slave. The most important subjects to the mind of man and for the soul of man and the heart of man is a relationship with God through religion, is control of his future through the political process, and is control of his security and serenity through the judicial process. And these three things we have been taught in school and everywhere around us, the airwaves and everything, telling us to stay away from that, telling us you're not capable of doing that. And so people feel inadequate when they come to those three subject lines, and they run away from them, and they don't know why, they don't question why, they just do. They don't discuss these things, and all these things need to be discussed in the same arena. We've been taught that you have to separate these things. The fact of the matter is you've got to combine these things. This is the essence of man. But Thomas Jefferson said, and we have this right on the front page of our website, right under the statement, only the people can save America. I know no safe depository of the ultimate powers of the society but people themselves. And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion by education. This is the true corrective abuses of constitutional power. And I'd like to just read two more. They're kind of short. Educate and inform the whole masses of the people. They are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. And the third one, an enlightened citizenry is indispensable for the purpose functioning, for the proper functioning of a republic. Self-government is not possible unless the citizens are educated sufficiently to enable them to exercise oversight. It is therefore imperative that the nation see to it that a suitable education be provided for all its citizens. Now, this is the problem, and this is a conspiracy. There's no getting away from it. People, the progressive movement people, have taken over the controls of our government. They've controlled our education, taken over control of our religion, control of our political process. And they've instilled in us a runaway attitude from all these things. And if we do deal with them, well, you go find yourself a priest or a pastor, or you go find yourself a political party, or you go find yourself a lawyer, and they'll take care of it for you. And that is your heritage. Your heritage is liberty, and the heritage is the execution and the exercising of that liberty, of that heritage. So this is the only way. Now, we put National Liberty Alliance together. We had no intentions of doing this nationally. Our intention was to work within our own state, and in that process, we hope that other states would see what we're doing and then, follow along. But in the process, very early on, we discovered that we were having people from all over the nation coming into our meetings, and they were asking questions and asked how it was done in their state, so on and so forth. And so we were kind of drafted into the national movement. And so we started this about 10 months ago. And in that time period, we have infiltrated every single state of the union. We are active in all 50 states now. And we are building common law grand juries in all the counties. Our intention is to get one in every single county throughout the nation. That's 3,143 of them. And our website is built in such a way to give people a true classical education. Anybody who wants a classical education and didn't get it when they were a child, because we should have had that between the ages of one, I mean between the school grade of 1 and 8. We don't need any more than 8 years in school. But they keep us in school. They get us very young, and they keep us until we become a young adult. And that's in that process, they're molding us. They're creating the slave mind mentality, and so we need a classical education, as Jefferson said, and to enlighten the people. So we have on our site we teach people the law, how to access the law, the process, the procedures. We teach people common law. So we get into the civics, we teach people the political process, we have American history, we have all the great works, all the great thinkers, we even have mathematics, we have Euclid, the father of mathematics, and we even have Bible studies. And so we've put together a very rounded education for people, to re-educate the people. And it's up to the people to have the ability to get up and step up to bat and go back to school, re-educate yourself. And as we're boning up to prepare for the knowledge we're going to need to do the job that the people should be doing, we're organizing. So we invite everyone to come join us, and let's save America, because there's not much time.
Let me stop you right there, John, and let me ask you a couple of questions about some things you said, okay?
Because sure.
I think that one of the things that I've learned as a pastor over all these years, that every field of endeavor has technical terminology. Even in my teaching and my teaching as a pastor, biblically there is some technical terminology that must be understood if we're going to make any sense out of human history. So I want to go back and, first of all, ask you a question. How do we get a copy of Common Law Handbook? Is it available to us?
Oh, yeah. We have the Common Law Handbook on a website. We've got probably the only one that's really the true Common Law Handbook. I haven't found one that's really good out there. They always bring you back to control. This brings you to freedom. This frees the spirit. It frees the heart. It frees the man, and brings us under the rule of God. And you could find that under our Juris tab on the right side. You go to our Juris tab, and you'll get a drop-down box, and there you will find Juris Documents. And of the Juris Documents, I think it's about the ninth item down, you'll see a copy of our Juris Handbook. So you can print it out the way it is. If you have a two-sided printer, it'll make a nice booklet that you fold up. And eventually we will be getting a little handbook, so maybe 40, 50 pages of those little handbooks, like a constitutional booklet, that'd be able to stick in your pocket. So.
Let me ask you this then. You can get a copy of the Common Law Handbook, and I recommend it. Go out to the website and find it on the website. Secondly, I want to ask three questions that are related to each other. First of all,
let me just say one other thing about that tab. There is certain information on this website that people will not see unless they decide to become to register as a jurist. And that tab, the jurist tab, is the tab that's on the inside of the website. You have to sign in to get it. There's a few other pages under other tabs that also are inside availability only. So just so people know, they go out, they don't see the jurist tab all the way on the right. They don't see that unless they register. But go ahead.
Okay, the next question, there's three of them right behind each other, and I'd like for you to try to answer them in order, and if I need to, I'll restate it again. I want to know, what is the meaning of common law? What is a grand jury? And what is common law grand jury? So first of all, what is common law?
Well, common law is natural law. It's the law of God. Ultimately, common law came from Mosaic law. It wasn't traced directly down to us, but it has an interesting history because, of course, you know, the Lord always told us and taught us, as you look through into Mosaic law, and then you go through the history of the Bible and you start to see other people wanted a king, and the Lord said, hey, I'm the king, you know, you don't need a king. They still wanted a king, and then all kinds of trouble started. And so it's the same thing, you know, here. In England, that's exactly how they set it up originally, with a king, and the king was to take care of the worker and maintain the freedom of the free people by being the sovereign. They put their sovereignty into one person, and of course, from time to time, that king went astray and caused problems. But where it came from originally, the idea came from into England in about maybe 300 or 400 A.D. The Anglo-Saxons brought in this idea of being ruled over by the mind of God and not by the mind of man. And so they were working out this way of being ruled over through maxims, and a maxim is a truth that cannot be denied. I'll give you two examples. You know, water cannot go uphill. Water does not go uphill, and no one would argue with that point. A thing similar is not necessarily the same thing. Again, no one can argue that point either. So this is how they were trying to work out the law, was through maxims. Anyway, they came to England about 300 or 400 A.D., and they met with the Bible. And they believed that common law was not written law, that it works out through logic and through the hearts of men. And when they met with the Bible, they realized that there was one book of common law, and that was the Bible. So common law really emanates from the Bible. It's natural law. It's the law of nature. It's the law that God set up. It's the law that God put into our hearts. You know, there's a foundational law, and all law hangs upon this, and that is to love God with all your heart and with all your soul, and the second is like unto the first, to love your neighbor as yourself. And upon these are built all the laws. And so that's the foundation and the fundamental part of common law. And it brings you to self-rule by the people, and that's where the juries come in. So the grand jury, really the first time we see this in history that I'm aware of is in the Magna Carta, where the king went out of control and the people were suffering. And so the people came together, the 25 dukes or freemen, numerous different names are used for these people. But in any event, they were the people, they were the freemen. And so 25 of them got together, and they met the king along the side of the road, and they took him out of his carriage, and they put the axe to his head, and they put a paper before him, and he had two choices, you know, to lose his head or sign the paper. And the paper brought forth the agreement between the people and the king. So, of course, he signed the paper. Later on, there was some changes that were made sometime later, not too long later, but sometime later. And one of the changes that they made is that they did repent that they threatened the life of the king without due process. So they put that into the Magna Carta that they would never do that to take the life of the king or the family and so on and so forth. They would save the life. And, of course, that is the proper thing. So the Magna Carta established the first grand jury and how the jury might work. And one of the things they had in the Magna Carta, I'm not sure whether it's paragraph 59 or 61, I think it's 61, where it says that should any problem arise among the people, that four of the 25 would be sent out to try to work out and repair that problem. And if they couldn't fix that problem, they would bring it to the 25. And the 25 would straightway go to reinstate the injury to the injured party. Now, of course, later on, we went into the trial, where if the grand jury can't settle it between the two parties, then they send it into the trial jury, the 12, who will then make the final decision on behalf of the parties, if they can't settle it between them. And so, you know, common law has no desire to put people in jail. It may be a criminal act. You might steal something from somebody, and that has to be, you know, made right again. So common law is all about restitution. Common law requires that the person who injured the other person repair the person they injured. And that makes all the sense in the world, and that's a godly way of doing it, because in that process, you very well may be an individual, may return back into society and become a part of society and someone who could start to do good things instead of evil. And who knows, in that process, a soul may be saved. So this is what common law is all about. The only people that belong in jail would be really violent people. And in my opinion, I think most judges, because judges have done violence to the Constitution. Judges have taken on control and authority that there was never given to them. And they have caused so much suffering that there's no way they can repay back the people. So, you know, if a judge is found guilty of injuring people, jail might be the required thing. He could never recompense the suffering that he's given. I've heard of judges who have come into retirement and then boasted on how in their career they have handed out a million years of jail sentence. And that's pretty pathetic, a statement for someone to say something like that. No less, most of the people that they put in, if not all of them, don't even deserve to be in jail. You know, we have a Second Amendment, which gives us a right to have a weapon and to defend ourselves, and yet they've licensed this and permitted this, made money off this, restricted this, prevented this, and yet if you're caught with a weapon, then they will put you in jail. A lot of people in jail for that. Or your right to travel, because you don't have the proper papers for them. We have the right to travel, and people are in jail for that. So it was Bork. Judge Bork, for those who remember Judge Bork who was going up for the United States Supreme Court back in the 80s during the Reagan administration, he had said that 90% of the people that are in jail are there because they opened their mouths. And what that meant was they gave consent to that judge before them and that process before them. When you go into a court, which is called a nisi prius court, that which is not common law, they have no authority over you unless you consent. So when they bring you in to make a plea, they're looking for you to give them consent. Your plea is consent to them. If you plea on not guilty, well, you've consented to their process, and now they can try you and put you in jail or fine you or whatever it is they're going to do with you. Okay, so that...
Let me stop you right there, because I think I don't want to run out of time here unless you're willing to come back, because I got a bunch of questions.
Sure, go right ahead.
That I want our folks educated on. And so where does a common law grand jury find its authority for existence? And just as briefly as you can, answer that question.
Sure. The first place you find it is in the Declaration of Independence, where it is stated that we have government by the consent of the people. And the only way that people can consent to government is through authority, and this is the only authority available.
Okay. Well, what place does Chief Justice Antonin Scalia, in a 6-3 Supreme Court decision, what significance is his writing in that paper that he talked about, that 6-3 decision?
All right. Well, you know, the Supreme Court rulings is law across the entire nation. Any ruling that the United States Supreme Court makes, all judges must comply to, and they have to rule the same way. This is the law, and the United States Supreme Court was set up for the sole purpose of setting right or wrong, and particularly they have authority over grand juries only if the grand jury, in their judgments, or in whatever it is that they do, or even a trial jury, if they were to violate another human being, another person's unalienable rights, and that person went and complained to the United States Supreme Court, and they agreed with them, that's the only way that the United States Supreme Court can overrule a grand jury or a trial jury, and that is if someone's unalienable rights are absolutely proven to have been violated. Other than that, they even stated in United States versus Williams, a 1992 case, and many, many other cases, all the way going back into the beginning of our nation, and they have stated many times that the United States Supreme Court does not have the authority or the power to overrule the jury, period.
I guess what I'm looking for is what did Scalia say about a fourth branch of government that most people don't really understand?
Well, yeah, he likened the grand jury like a fourth branch of government. I don't necessarily like that statement, but I understand it and people can appreciate it. Because really, when you say there's a fourth branch of government, that kind of puts us on an equal level with the other three branches, and that they may be able to trump us and we can trump them. But where the truth of the matter is, and Scalia does cover this in his case, and it does become clarified, is once the grand jury makes a ruling, whether it be in the judicial realms, the political realms, and of course inside the court itself, it's forever. It's eternal and it's sealed and it cannot be overturned. And of course, again, if it's discovered some kind of a discrepancy or something, and you can fix that, and another grand jury can do that too. But that's where the powers are. Now, in this decision, he made it quite clear the beauty about the United States versus Williams case is that almost everything that Scalia had said is what's called dicta. In court, when you look at a Supreme Court ruling and you're using it in order to support a case that you're battling at, there's two different positions that could be used from a court case. And one is on point, which means the court case is pretty much the same kind of a case you have and addressing the point. The other thing is what's called in dicta. And in dicta is not directly related to the case, but certain truths are mentioned in that case that could be used in your case. On point is usually more powerful than dicta. But the beauty of Scalia's decision, even though it was almost everything he did in there was on dicta, it seemed like a couple of things. First of all, he was trying to pour out, in my opinion, his research on the grand jury, and it might have been a lifelong research, because in that one case he had put in so much facts and the authorities and the powers of the grand jury, and there really wasn't a reason for it in this particular case, but he did it anyway, and I think it was his opportunity to do it, and he did it so people could pick up on it and hopefully save the nation by utilizing and exercising that. But what he did do is he had lots of references to all the authorities where he got his information from. And in those places, you will find on-point cases. So it's a very unique kind of a case that, yeah, it's in dicta, but all the cases he refers to are on point to exactly this point or this topic, which is the grand jury. And so the grand jury, he made certain rules that the grand jury is to be at arm's length from the judge. And to be at arm's length, if you look into the meaning of that, it means they're running away from, stay away, keep your distance, you're not part of me. So we're separated from the judge. And the only thing the judge gets to do is he gets to call for the trial jury, okay, which means he would call out to the people to impanel them. Unfortunately, today the courts impanel them. But he gets to give them the oath. Other than that, he has no other connection with them. So he also made a point in this case, Scalia did, and others went along with him, that the grand jury is to be impaneled and controlled, either brought together, controlled, totally by the people. And right now we have corporatism in our courts, corporatism everywhere. Our states have been incorporated, our municipalities, all the towns, cities, the counties have been incorporated, the United States has been incorporated. And the definition of corporatism really brings you to Nazism. And that's where we're at today. We're very close to that point. All these places are incorporated. And they're operating under corporate charter and not the Constitution. And that's why people are not seeing justice.
Okay.
This
is great information. But I want to go back for just a moment, because we're going to go there about this, about the corporation. I want to ask that question. But I want to come back to this idea of the fourth branch of government.
Right.
If Scalia said or stated that a common law grand jury is the fourth branch of government, whether he concludes that in victa or on point, he made that statement, and the fourth branch of government is in fact we the people.
Exactly.
In fact, the president or the Congress or the Supreme Court could overrule the fourth branch of government, which is the common law grand jury. Of what value is it? Why don't we hang up our hat and get out of here because we don't stand a chance?
Right. Well, let me tell you the powers of the grand jury, and we'll look a little more at United States versus Williams. But the authority and the power of the grand jury and what their duty of the grand jury is to fix and make right any wrongdoing they come up that they find, whether it be in the judicial or the political realm. So if you have a politician that's out of line, you have a bureaucrat that's out of line, you have a judge that's out of line, a court that's not properly running as a common law court, the grand jury can send out their four investigators, and they have total, it's the boss walking into the office and asking the people to move aside, walk in, look into their computers, open up their drawers. We own it. This is our property. That's the power of the grand jury.
Huh? What does it mean to be out of line?
What does it mean to be out of line?
Yeah, you said, if somebody in these positions are out of line, I think we need,
when you go into government offices, I have experienced this many times. You go into a government office and you ask for something and they give you a hard time and you push back a little bit. And next thing you know, you're being treated disrespectfully. They're not giving you what you need, or you're not getting the law applied correctly. For instance, let's take the committee man. They've taken the committee man and they've expunged the elected committee man and they've turned it over to two private associations, Republican and Democratic parties, who operate just like a communist parties top down. And when we went to the New York State Board of Election and showed them the law and said, "Look at you're not obeying the law and you're not permitting for the elected committee man to come into power." And they ignored that and resisted that. We sued them twice, and the courts wouldn't allow the law to be applied. That's how corrupt our courts are. And so that's being out of line, and you're being disrespected. Now, we found, since we've been working on this and going around to these courts and trying to get access into the courts, because that's where we're supposed to be operating from, we found that they are frightened of us. They all of a sudden treat us with respect. They literally stutter. And when we speak, they shut up. And when we ask them questions, they do answer. So we do know there's authority in this. The judges on the high level here in New York are resisting in every way and preventing us from having a seat in the court, which gives us total authority as the people. And we're trying to do this across the whole nation. So the battle is on, and the battle is here in New York, and the battle is in Florida. You'll see it in Pennsylvania, Ohio, California. It's erupting all across this nation. But again, I'll give you some quotes from Scalia's decision. Here's a good quote. He said that the common law, that the grand jury is rooted in long centuries of Anglo-Saxon American history. Okay, the grand jury is mentioned in the Bill of Rights, but not in a body of the Constitution. It has been textually assigned, therefore. It has not been textually assigned, therefore, to any of the branches described in the first three articles. It is a constitutional fixture in its own right. In fact, the whole theory of its function is that it belongs to no branch of the institutional government, serving as kind of a buffer or referee between the government and the people. And so it's found in the Fifth Amendment, and it's an unalienable right. And therein is the battle. And when you go into the states, it's very appalling here, because you go into the states and they say, "Oh, that's for the federal government. That has nothing to do with us." So what they're saying is that the Fifth Amendment is irrelevant in your state. In my case, it's New York State. And this is the battle, and it's a battle of words, and it's really going to be decided by the people ultimately when the news finally reports the news and tells the people what's going on. We've been informing 800 different news outlets every time we've made a move here in New York, and we just had some people doing some things down in Florida, and we made some reports, and we notify over 800 outlets, and not one of them is running the story. So that's how controlled our news media is. But eventually, this is going to become so big that they're not going to be able to hold it back.
Yeah, well, let me ask this question then. What kind of knowledge do the circuit court clerks, judges, prosecutors, what kind of knowledge do they have of the common law grand jury? Are they taught this in their schooling, or is this ignored?
Yeah, they have no knowledge. It's totally ignored. There is a conspiracy. They have taught, the bar schools have been teaching our lawyers, bar schools here, you know, have been around since the early 1900s. And they have been teaching our lawyers that common law has been done away with, it's passe, it's not needed no more, and they teach them statutes. So when you go before a judge, this person is acting off of statutes, and the lawyers are acting and fighting their cases off of statutes. When you bring up common law, it's like a deer in the headlights. They have no clue. And they say, oh, that's passe, that's been done away. They truly believe that. And, of course, just the opposite is true. As late as 2001, the people of New York particularly recertified the fact in the Constitution that the common law grand jury will always be in effect and never be taken away from the people. It'll always have the authority and the power to investigate any place within government, and that includes the judicial realms. So they've been taught a lie. It's called the fiction. When you bring these things up to them, they get very confused and they can't respond, because we have tremendous, tremendous amount of history, tremendous amounts of court cases that lay this out. We even have New York State law, I think it's 756, that says that the courts will and shall operate under common law. In the New York State Constitution, under Article 1, I believe it's subsection 10, it says that all courts are under courts of record, shall operate and go forward as a common law. The United States Supreme Court, has ruled this over and over again with the Supremacy Clause, that the common law is in full effect and is to be obeyed by all the judges. The only court available on the land, the American land, is common law. And so we should be operating under common law, but all the lawyers are taught that's been done away with, that's passe, and that therein is the conspiracy. But there is a way to battle that in the courts, but it's an uphill battle, and this is what the purpose of the grand jury is going to be, to reinstate the common law, to force it to be back into their courts.
I've got to ask you another question, though, that is important, I think, to the issue. I began to hear, I'm 79 years old, and I began to hear back in the 1970s, from the John Birch Society and members of the John Birch Society about a conspiracy. Well, listen, I understand the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. I understand eschatologically where we're going. If there's a conspiracy, there has to be a conspirator. Can you name the conspirator?
Well, it would be, we call them the elite, it's the elitist families. Sure, there's a lot of names out there. There's the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, the Morgans, the Warburgs. You know, that's just to name a few. There's a lot of names that we haven't heard. But it's probably about 100, maybe at most 200 families that really, they've been around for a long, long time. And, you know, it goes all the way back to England. They controlled England, and that was the big purpose of the revolution. England was under the squeeze by these families. They owed them monies. They took control of the money, of the monetary system of England. And England was trying to pay off the debt and had to serve its master, which ultimately you'll see within the Rothschild family, and so they put a lot of pressure on the Americas, and that's what caused us, you know, to rebel. We were being taxed to death, and the big statement, no taxation without representation, the Boston Tea Party, all of that was all about money and the control of this nation, which was a colony then. And that's what really, and when they started to come and arrest the people and really suppress them, what they found is that they were unable to really get a court case that would stick against any of the people, because they had to go before the grand jury. So the judges and so on complained to the king that, hey, they can't arrest these people because they know the law and they're exercising the common law. So what the king did is then they actually came in and they kidnapped these people and brought them to England to start on trial. And when you read the Declaration of Independence, it lays this out, that people were being carried away to foreign places in order to be prosecuted unrighteously, and so on. And this is what caused the revolution. And from the very beginning, in 1789, when Washington was elected president, the first president for a federal government system, right then and there, the enemy was already in the office working. Alexander Hamilton was leaned towards the bankers, and the bankers is what really has been causing the problem. And it's all about money. This goes all the way back to the Lord's Day with the money changers. Same thing, same problem, the control of money. And so it's been here for a long time, and it's all in the families. They're inbred, and they have a society unto their own. And this is what people call the New World Order. You know, they have controlled and manipulated mankind for thousands of years, ultimately, these families. And they have caused many of havoc and many of the wars. And they've always supported both sides because they keep the wars going. They make money on that. Also, it weakens the nation and gives them more control of the monetary system. You control the monetary system, they move in. The Bar Association works with them to control the judicial system. And, you know, the bottom line, if you control the courts, you control the nation. Now, I know Rothschild made a statement some years back, of course, it was quite some time ago, and he says, give me control of a nation's money, and I don't care who makes the laws, because I'm going to control everything. But what he left out is he needed control of the courts. If you get the courts to be, if you control the courts and bring the courts to courts of injustice, which is what we have in the United States right now, that injustice will permeate up through the entire government, and you'll have nothing but criminality everywhere. And that's what we have. But if you can bring those courts back to the courts of justice, and the word justice in Black's Law Dictionary is synonymous with virtue. If you can bring that back to a godly way, bring our courts back to a godly justice, then that will permeate up to all of government and all of society, and we would have a godly society. And that's what they robbed from us. Because, you know, if you have the light on in a courthouse, they're going to be hiding, the criminals are going to be hiding behind rocks and in the darkness of corners. Yes. Yes, I read that book.
Well, he makes a statement there while he wasn't necessarily quoting the Bible. What he indicated was that man will seek a political position for the purpose of getting in on the money and or control. And if we're looking at the Bible and we want to talk some spiritual, I believe the conspiracy goes back first to the Rothschild. It goes
back yes.
to the Garden of Eden. And if we're going to talk about human history, why God created human history, where it's headed, then we're going to have to talk about the depravity of man.
That's
the
right.
The depravity of man indicates that man is going to do one of three things. He's either going to pursue pleasure, prevent pain, or seek as an elitist a political position to get in on the greed and or to control. Now, with that in mind, I see spiritually that while the Rothschilds and others may be involved in this, all they are is unbelieving people or carnal believers who are functioning from the source of the old man and pursuing pleasure, preventing pain, and trying to control the people under that are in this country. So I see it as a satanic movement. And the truth of the matter is that if we get rid of the Rothschilds, we're still going to have the totally depraved man. And look at all that's going on up in Washington D.C. with these people. These are not spiritual people. So I'm sorry to preach a little bit, but back to you, sir.
Well, absolutely. The Bible tells us that the hearts of men are desperately wicked. Who could know it? And we trace this all the way back. When we trace the law, it goes all the way back to Babylonia. That's where the civil law comes from, the control of people. And, of course, that's the civil law side, the mind of man, to control men. And the other law goes back all the way to Moses, where Moses received the law on the mountain, and that's the law of God. And so there's been a battle between man and God, the spirit of man and the spirit of God, from the very beginning. You're absolutely correct. And you're right, we can never create the Garden of Eden on earth. That'll never happen. Only when the good Lord comes in the clouds of glories and changes us all in the twinkling of an eye will we have such a way of being. But the bottom line is God speaks about blessing his people. And, you go back and you read throughout the Old Testament and see the battles and the things that took place during the days of Moses. And after Moses died and they went over the over the Jordan, and Joshua led them, and all of the battles. I mean, there was one time when they disobeyed God, and they went out to battle, and they lost. For the first time, they had lost. And Joshua repented, and the people, and they caught the people that had violated, and they killed them. You know, they executed them. And God said, do the right thing. And after that, they didn't lose any battles, and they took the land. And God was using the Jews in those days in order to bring judgment upon the promised land. And I'm not sure on this, but it may have been, the family of Esau that really had, covered that land. You may know that more than I do. But in any event, the bottom line is this battle has always been here. But nevertheless, when people are being obedient to God, and we teach this is the point. You know, if people think they're going to do this without godliness, then they're fooling themselves. First order of business is fix up your spiritual house. Go into your prayer closets. Talk to the Lord and work things out. That's your private, personal thing, and you all need to do that. And that's the first order of business, to fix your spiritual house, to get under the rule of God and the will of God. And the other thing, now you take that and you come in, we got to bring justice back into the courts. Again, Black's Law Dictionary, justice is synonymous with virtue. And we're supposed to have, houses of justice, and that's our courthouses. And so when people come in there, if you have a just system and you're in the will of God, God's going to bless that more. Now, we can have a much better life and a much better society if we can bring our halls of justice back to justice and being godly. We're not going to have a perfect society because you're absolutely right. The hearts of men are desperately wicked. Who could know it? And there'll always be that assault. But it is possible that it may be God's will to bless this nation. It may be, it may be God's will to bring justice upon the evil of this world through the bringing back of justice into the courts. Because indeed, if you were able to bring justice back into the, 3,143 common law courthouses, you definitely would bring justice onto these individuals that have destroyed this nation. Because that will happen all on its own. You don't even have to go on a witch hunt to do that. And that's the other thing. We are not there for a witch hunt. Our purpose is to save the republic. And so that's our focus, and that's the prize. If judges, how evil they are, that's their problem, and they have to work that out with God. Whatever they do from this point forward, that's all we're interested in. We're not here to go after their sins or anything like that of the past. We're here to let's get forward into the future. Do the right thing and we're all good. And you can have Hitler in power if he's doing the right thing because he has no choice, because you're going to require that and he'll have to pay the toll if he doesn't, then you'll have an order. I can't know a man's soul. That's between him and God.
I want to ask you a question. You don't have to answer it if you don't want to, but mm-hmm. I think it'll put something into perspective for our listening audience. Are you a born-again Christian?
Oh, absolutely.
No question. You are?
I no question. I am a born-again Christian, and my will is his will, not mine. Of course, I'm a sinner like anyone else, and I do the best I can. But I do try every day when I make a decision, is I try to make it in favor of the will of the Lord and not my own. And I know if I make the right decision, everything in life is really a lot of little decisions, okay? You don't really get, it's not a big thing. And if you make those little decisions, the right decisions, all of a sudden you're seeing that you're living a good life and you're doing the right thing. And it's as simple as that. It doesn't get any more complex than that. But it is hard for individuals to do that. And I know before I was born again, that was the case for me.
Yeah, I understand. So you are a born-again Christian. Second question, do you have a church background, a denominational church background, what do you attend church?
Well, I don't go to church anymore. I went to church for many, many years. I went from church to church. I've discovered that, I didn't understand exactly what was going on, but I always saw a conflict between a lot of preachers and pastors with the Bible. They didn't seem to really go along with the Bible. Often they would go off on these strange doctrines. And so I've had a lot of struggles in the churches, at least wherever I've been. And I live in my Bible, and I have a relationship with God, and presently I don't go to church. But my family believes in God, and we have the Bible, and that's how we live our life. And all our decisions is, with Christ in mind.
Yeah. Would it surprise you if, as a pastor, and here again, sir, I'm not here to convert you to anything,
mm-hmm.
for money, I don't want you to join anything, but would it surprise you in the National Liberty Alliance, you probably got all kinds of backgrounds, but I hear you talking about the Old Testament. Would it surprise you to find out that a guy like me understands that the Mosaic Law was great for Israel, but has nothing to do with the church, because, in fact, in the church age, in the Pauline epistles, that by divine revelation, Paul has given us 9 of the 10 commandments stated under grace rather than under law.
Absolutely. The law came through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. I brought up a lot of the Old Testament only because of the history. Oh no, I live in the New Testament. You know, our first Bible study that we have online, which is a very in-depth Bible study and the study of the harmony of the four Gospels, is exactly that. It's the study of the New Testament, and everyone needs to start off at the feet of Christ. I know when I became a Christian and I was struggling to understand things, and I opened my Bible, and I was very confused. And it wasn't until I found myself in the Gospels, and I stayed in the Gospel for many, many years before I started to branch out to looking in the Old Testament and looking into the epistles. I couldn't understand any of that.
No, I understand. And that's fine. My concern is, too, though, that in the Gospels, and again, I'm not preaching, sir, I'm just sort of telling you.
Right,
I
understand.
I want to be a part.
Absolutely.
Of the common law grand jury. I want to be a part of the National Liberty Alliance. But I want people to know where I'm coming from. And while I have a website, Saving America's Freedom, I'm not in this to get the members of NLA to come into my camp. That's not it. I want to be a part of anything that's working out here to save America's freedom. And the reason for that is freedom is the most fundamental principle of all of human history. It's given to us by God, and that means I've got the privilege of either doing the right thing or the wrong thing. But it's only the right thing that's going to bless me and glorify Him in this period of time called human history. So my contention is that I want, in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, in the harmony of those Gospels, we can harmonize them, but isn't it interesting that Jesus spoke about the Mosaic Law, he spoke about the Kingdom Law and the Millennium, and he spoke about the Church Age for the Church Age believer in certain passages, and so many Christians, John, become so confused because there seem to be conflicting statements in an area. And if we want to find the truth, we better get into the Apostle Paul and his writings in his letters, but I'm with you, pal.
Well, I agree with your conclusions here. Before you can get into the epistles, of course, and really understand what Paul is talking about, you have to be at the feet of Jesus, and I know you agree with that. You know, I come to realize when I first came into my Bible and I was finally led to the Gospels, and I realized that, you know, I didn't understand the Gospels either, but I understood it was convicting my heart. You know, I got into the Beatitudes, and then I went into the Sermon on the Mount, and wow, did God convict my heart and make me see that I was a sinner. And I struggled for years inside the four Gospels at the feet of Jesus. And I came to realize when he looked out onto the multitudes, he wasn't just talking about one place and time where he physically was. He was talking about me and everyone else that was opening that book. We were those multitudes. He was looking out into all the way to the ends of the world. And so that's how I saw it, and I grew with it. And of course, once you got when you start to get the understanding of the parables and the historical parables, and you understand who Christ is, that he is literally God himself, that in Christ Jesus dwelleth the Godhead bodily, and all these things that he teaches you in these Gospels, then, of course, now you can, because I remember reading Romans, and I was totally lost. But after going through the Gospels and open up Romans, Romans just opened up to me. And the Ephesians and Galatians and even Revelations. And Revelations is a synopsis of the entire Bible, and really ultimately the bringing man into judgment and the salvation into and judgment. And those two things are always in view. But I know there are plenty of groups of people, churches, fellowships, and everything else that are true to the Word of God and to the Lord. I'm sure that's God's business. He knows where they're at. But I can tell you, as for me, I don't see him where I live. But I did, you know, there was one good church I was going to not too long ago. It was one of the last churches I went to, and the pastor was very wise and very blessed, and we had great conversations. Every time I was in his presence, I was edified, and I hoped I did the same for him. And so we had great conversations. But you know, he was an elderly guy, and they were starting a church, and it failed. It never drew enough members, and so they closed it down. And I went to the sister church, and it was like night and day. I had to leave; couldn't stay there. The last church I went to, I thought was one of the best churches I had found. I mean, the preaching was dynamic and moving, and I would go and sit and talk with the pastor and the elders and the people, and I'd say, hey, you know, it's Sunday, you know, the church would end at about 12 o'clock, and we'd go in for, you know, having coffee and stuff, and by 1 o'clock everybody was out and the doors were shut, and I was trying to convince them, why don't we spend the whole day in the Lord? We should do Bible studies, and maybe even if it's only a small group. But as I started talking to these people, what I realized is that they were preaching some of the great preachings that are written in books, and that they really didn't understand it. I was depressed by that.
Well, let me ask you a question. I'm not sure whether you have my email address. I've got yours. But I don't have an address to which I can send it. And I'm not trying to convert you at all and get
right.
But I'd like to send you a copy of the first book that I wrote. It's called Christianity and Spiritual Perspective. Are you sick and tired of being sick and tired?
I hear you.
and I think it would be a help to you. I'm not asking you to join anything, but I think it would be helping you to understand again the difference between the religion out there and the spiritual side of the Christian way of life. You've experienced
it. I understand.
I'd like to bring it in perspective for you.
Well, look, if you want to send me a copy, you can go out onto the website, click on contact, click on donations, and in the bottom of donations, there's an address you can send something to me at, the physical address. but let me just say that this one thing, you know, look, the problem is ultimately with the entire nation. We were a blessed nation, and now I believe we're a cursed nation. Because we've gone astray, we've left justice, we've left God, we've left the Christianity, and that's going to show up even in our churches. And you know, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and spiritual wickedness in the high places. And those high places is in the churches. That's the high places. And you know, God spoke about this in Revelations, and he talked about those who are in the house of Satan and didn't even realize it. In other words, he's got his people in the churches, even if they're the house of Satan, and he's protected them. Because, you know, when Satan takes a seat in that temple, you know, and he's been, you know, churches have been going astray from the very beginning. I find it very interesting when you go back and you read the Bible as a book. And, you know, you can't really read the Bible as a book straight from beginning to end until you've really sat at the feet of Jesus and really worked through the Bible from his perspective, from those Gospels. But once you kind of start to understand what the meaning of these things are, and the parables and the spiritual understanding of all these things, and you go back and you read it as a book, and now you can comprehend it you know, to a decent degree. You know, the genealogies get involved in a whole different story. But when you get into that and you look and you see the people constantly, God was going to destroy the people, Israel, many times. Moses came up on their behalf, oh, Lord, please forgive them. And it's constant, men are going astray. And every time God sets up something beautiful for them, a generation later, they're gone. You know, take it to Joshua, then you get into the kings. And I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And it's no different in the New Testament in that sense than in the Old Testament. God sets up a church and things are going great, but Satan creeps into that church and lead astray, the people. And again, when one goes down, God raises up again. No one's going to stop the relationship that he has with his people. And whether you're in a church or out of a church, if you can find a good place to fellowship with people, by all means, that's what we should be doing. And
in the interest of your time, sir,
yeah.
I asked you for an hour time, okay? And mm-hmm. In the interest of your time, I'm going to ask you, I've got 17 questions and we got through three, okay? I know how important your time is.
Well, I'll speak to you anytime you want. We can continue.
Okay, so I want to ask you this. Would you be willing to come back? Would you be willing to return next Tuesday?
Sure.
Same station.
Sure, Tuesday. That's fine.
Okay, well, I'll send you confirmation of that, and we'll get you back next Tuesday because I've got some other questions. And I think, John, as a result of your being on this program, I look forward to the time where I believe and anticipate that we will have people that will become a part of the National Liberty Alliance by driving them out to the website to learn more about this. But I think
right. Yeah, we need godly people out there, and the message is that we have to return to the Lord. We have to come with a bent knee. Our principles are built upon, we must develop, in order to become a good jurist, you must develop a sense of honor, a sense of justice, and a sense of mercy. Those are the principles. And you lose any one of those three principles, we're not going to be doing things godly, and we're not going to be blessed for whatever it is we do.
I think that after an hour's time, many times I see people who are interviewing, the interviewer, like me, asks all the questions. At the end of an hour, you might say, gee whiz, we were on there for an hour, and the guy never did ask me this question. Is there a question that I did not ask before we leave? You say, I'm going to go ahead and give him the answer. Is there anything like that that you want to...
No, not offhand. I just respond to whatever comes to me. I just ad-lib everything, and, I don't know. You know, whatever interests people or whatever answers people want, if I can help them, it just spills out of this mouth of mine, so to speak. You know, I've studied the Bible for a very long time, literally spending, 8 hours, 10 hours a day sometimes in the Bible. I had an earnest ongoing desire to learn and do the will of God and to understand the Bible. I struggled with the book of Revelation and to understand. I understand now it's completely all parables, of course. In that process, God has led me somehow to where I'm at right now. So I started studying law, and I found out that law is not being applied in our courts. And I found out that law comes from God. It comes from the Bible. That's where common law comes from. So it really interested in me. And God led me here. And so I've dove deep into, Supreme Court decisions and looking into the history of common law and tracing it back into Babylonia as far as the civil law is concerned and onto the mountain with Moses as far as the law of God is concerned. And I saw the battle. And I looked at our founding fathers and the people that they studied off of. And all of it, again, every one of them brings us right back to God, to Jesus Christ.
Well, if you're studying the Bible 8 hours a day, have you ever asked yourself what spiritual gift you have?
Well, I guess discernment, if anything. I have plenty of spiritual gifts. I'm born again, and God has given me great discernment. He's blessed me with a great family, and I don't have anything like maybe tongues or any of those kind of things. But I do have understanding. Excuse me? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Thank you, sir.
No, I didn't hear what you just said.
I said I'm glad you don't have the gift of tongues, because tongues...
Oh, no. Right. I agree. It doesn't exist, because that would be adding to the Word of God. And God has already sealed it up, that everything he's had to say, that which is perfect, has come. And he's come in the person of Jesus Christ, and he left that essence in a book and in the hearts of those of us who have become born again. And we collectively, Jesus Christ dwells in us collectively as a people wherever we're at.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I own the station, and we could go on and on and on and on. But in interest of your time, I will close right now. And I'll send you a confirmation, and we'll be back again next Tuesday, same time, same station.
Sounds good. Okay, Jim. Good talking with you.
God bless you, pal. Thanks for being
here. You too. Godspeed.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.